It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The Dutch city of Utrecht under fire today. A gunman boarding a streetcar at a busy intersection, blasting away at passengers before fleeing. Three people were killed, five injured, including three seriously.
Our thoughts go out to the relatives of the victims and people who witnessed this. Really terrible.
The city of 350,000 was on lockdown, the terror alert raised to its highest. Counter-terror police sought the suspected killer. And late today they caught him, 37-year-old Turkish-born Gökmen Tanas. It turned out he has a lengthy criminal record, including attempted manslaughter. Reports claimed he was initially targeting a woman in a family dispute, and others were hit.
We are investigating all possibilities, so that means possible terrorist motives, but also other possible personal motives.
This followed more horror last Friday in Christchurch, New Zealand. The country's prime minister mourning with families of the 50 killed in terror attacks at two mosques. Pledging proposals to regulate the weapons responsible would be presented by her government next week.
Within 10 days of this horrific act of terrorism, we will have announced reforms which will, I believe, make our community safer.
The owner of the shop where the 28-year-old Australian white nationalist bought some of his guns legally before the attacks and his arrest said he would abide by any new rules.
We are not a country of emotional responses. We are a country of laws.
Still, there is a lot of emotion evident days after the carnage for old and young.
As it did following the New Zealand attack, the U.S. reached out to the Netherlands today. Secretary of State Pompeo saying, America stands with you. We will do all we can to help you in this terrible time of tragedy.
Sandy Rios back with you. You know, we talked a great deal back with you. Yeah, after 24 hours on a new day on Tuesday. Good morning. That shooting in the Netherlands yesterday, of course, comes on the heels of the massacre in New Zealand of 50 Muslims in a mosque, in two different mosques, by an Australian man. Let me talk about Holland first. Three dead and nine wounded. And the interesting thing is what always happens. This was a Turkish young man. Of course, the Turks under Erdogan, not all Turks. Listen, I have personal friends that are Turkish who live in Turkey, who are not Islamists. But in this case, in spite of what they say, it appears to be a terrorist attack. And that's the thing. You know, all of these killings take place in Europe, these attacks, and even in the United States. And we all know that the authorities are quick to say, well, we don't know what the motive is. We're not sure. You know, we don't want to rush to say what it is. We hear that over and over again. And so the attacks from Islamists to what anybody that isn't are played down or not reported or attributed to mental illness or whatever. And yet the attack, of course, in New Zealand, the rush is, of course, to make it a white nationalist attack. I spent a great deal of time talking about that yesterday and explaining that this is not the basic war that the shooter in New Zealand was alluding to. He's talking about the Ottoman Empire and the Turks. Was not a war over racism. It was a war over deeply held religious Christian as opposed to Muslim beliefs that are not compatible. They just aren't. When you believe that your opponent has to be killed if they can't be conquered, that's a problem. And that's not the Christian view of the world. That is the essence, and Christian faith is the essence of Western civilization, which is now attributed to whiteness. So it's a total twisting, and I'm trying to untwist that in your own minds as you hear this being reported. And by the way, in the Netherlands, it was reported that in the past they haven't had a lot of big attacks. Of course, you have to realize if you haven't been to Europe how tiny Holland is. Tiny. Holland is like a little island. It's just tiny. I don't know how it compares to Israel, but I'd say they are comparable in terms of their square mileage. But In August, a 19-year-old Afghan with a German residence permit stabbed and injured two American tourists in Amsterdam's Central Station. Did you hear about that? I don't think so. In September, Dutch investigators said they had arrested seven people and foiled a major attack on civilians at a major event in the Netherlands. In June, two terror suspects were arrested while close to carrying out attacks, including an iconic bridge at Rotterdam. And then those men, by the way, are Moroccan origin. And as they filmed this bridge, they sang a martyrdom song. Did you hear about that? No, not so much. We are led to believe that the real massacre, the real killings, come from white supremacists who are birthed and inspired out of the West. So that's kind of the story in Holland yesterday, or in the Netherlands. Meanwhile, back in New Zealand, you heard a little bit from that report on by Greg Palcott, that the gun owners in New Zealand are bracing to have their right to carry really impinged. And the their leader, whose name escapes me in this moment, the female leader of New Zealand, is swearing that she's going to get this done, I think, in 11 days, which will be record-setting. Here it is. Australia took 12 days after the mass shootings for the government to finalize changes to its legislation. Took 2 years in the United Kingdom. But this Prime Minister, Ardern, has promised details of changes within 10 days of the attack. Their body, legislative body, has already passed something. The people just don't exactly know what it says. So their gun rights are going to be taken away. And I just have to point out, when this happens, we know that totalitarian states down through the ages have always pushed for strong gun control, because then they can control the citizenry. I mean, just how many movies have you watched about the Nazis overtaking Germany and the German citizens? By brutality and by disarming them. This is the way it goes down, and that's why Americans fight to keep their guns. That's why we fight. That's why our founding fathers made sure we had a right to bear arms. That was the Second Amendment to the Constitution, the right to bear arms. So anyway, so here's a really interesting article written by Tom Elliott, and this is what he says. What if the media, in its eagerness to neatly summarize the New England terrorists' attack with a good guys versus bad guys context, is getting things exactly backwards and is actually helping the terrorist realize his ultimate wish? And remember, the terrorist is still alive. It's going to be a long process. You know it is. And so he's watching from afar. And I want to read again a little bit about what was in his manifesto. If there's one large animating theme to the killer's 74-page manifesto, it's sowing chaos. If there's an ideology he subscribes to, it's the ideology of nihilism, an anti-ideology devoid of core principles beyond deriving pleasure from the pain of others. The killer specifically mentions his interest in exacerbating pre-existing divisions within the United States and bringing them to a boiling point. For every comment about his hatred of immigrants, there's another about his adoration of the environment. The manifesto appears destined to give both sides things to seize on so that they can turn on each other. And, of course, the media is happy to oblige. Rather than reporting the facts, the media is electing to selectively report on details from the manifesto, details that happen to coincide with the larger anti-Trump, anti-right-wing narrative. These reports are generously peppered with mentions of anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim. If you happen to be a member of one of those groups, you might be persuaded that your homeland isn't as welcoming as you had always believed. If you're a normal human being sympathizing with the victims and their families of this tragedy, you might be inclined to respond to all of this coverage by turning your anger against the president, against his supporters, and on. You get the point. So then he goes on to say, in short order, discord and disunity are ramped up exactly as the killer sought. And the killer celebrates his white identity in his manifesto while also holding up black conservative Candace Owens as one of his heroes. If you're trying to understand how all of this can simultaneously make sense, you're already giving this more thought than most of the major reporters covering the story. When the terrorist says he reveres Trump's white identity, he's quick to add that he doesn't support him as a political leader. He says he's open to the socialist label. He even describes himself as an eco-fascist. And by the way, CNN and MSNBC have yet to report either of those things. CNN and MSNBC have collectively mentioned the shooter's use of the word invaders no fewer than 100 times. He talks about protecting the environment. He says communist China is the nation that most clearly mirrors his own political preferences. And so he's just saying that the killer wanted to sow division. He's succeeding with it. And the media is just reporting, you know, to their own liking, the parts of the manifesto that advance their own narrative. And meanwhile, a couple of other pieces. A friend sent me a story about how could I get this quickly? A soldier, Gal Gaidan, in Israel, was killed by a Palestinian who, he was from a nearby village. He approached Gaidan and stabbed him. And as soon as Gaidan was wounded, the terrorist wrestled away his gun and shot him at point-blank range, killing him. A 47-year-old rabbi at the nearby town of Eli was on his way to work when he witnessed the attack. Ettinger turned his car around, that's the rabbi, and approached the terrorist. The rabbi drew his personal firearm and fired at the terrorist four times. So the rabbi volunteers to get into this. He sees what's happening. He sees he shot the soldier. He stops his car, turns around, comes back, and the terrorist ended up shooting Ettinger in the head. He died. He has 12 children. And he was buried along with the soldier on Monday. And meanwhile, the Palestinian Arabs handed out candy to celebrate the murder of the Jews. The point of that, to tell you that, is that we are accused of Islamophobia, which is patently ridiculous. We are not afraid of Islamophobia. I would go so far as to say we're not afraid of Islam, and we're not afraid of whatever they may bring, because the sad truth is, this is a people who serve a false god, and their premise and their teachings are dangerous and wicked and cause death. Remember that the Muslim Brotherhood's motto is, we love death more than they love life. So we have every reason in the world to object to that, and also to be concerned about their infiltration or assimilation into our culture, because they don't assimilate. They come and then they... I'm not saying every Muslim... I'm sure there are some exceptions, but I'm telling you, when push comes to shove, they would be hard-pressed to denounce the Quran and Sharia law. And so that's the problem. Their inclinations are going to be with adherence to Sharia law. You've seen that in countries around the globe when the burner is turned up on Sharia. Oh, so many more things to tell you. You know, I want to talk about that. David, Congressman Nunes suing Twitter. So let's go to clip one.
This is the 40-page lawsuit. It was filed in Virginia State Court late this afternoon. Twitter, as you said, in the hot seat as Congressman Nunes alleges the social media giant did not remove defamatory and malicious tweets. Nunes says that those tweets are from real people and bogus accounts, and the tweets carry Nunes and his family's name. I want to read some of that suit to you that was filed. It says, quote, Twitter knew the defamation was and is happening. Twitter let it happen because Twitter had and has a political agenda and motive. Twitter allowed and allows its platform to serve as a portal of defamation in order to undermine public confidence in plaintiff and to benefit his opponents and opponents of the Republican Party. Now, Nunes goes on to allege that these tweets were an effort to distract him from doing his job with the investigation of potential corruption in the 2016 presidential election. Quote, the purpose of the concerted defamation campaign was to cause immense pain, intimidate, interfere with, and divert Nunes' attention from his investigation of corruption and Russian involvement in the 2016 presidential election. And get this, Nunes is seeking $250 million. That number sounds large, and it is. And guess what? It's the same number as Covington Catholic student Nick Sandman. Now, he's suing for defamation. In his case, the Kentucky Catholic High School student, you see him right there, he was plastered all over the headlines for a confrontation with a Native American man back in January. We, of course, reached out to Twitter about this lawsuit. Just heard back from them within the last 5 minutes, though. They say that they are not commenting on this case, but we did hear from Nunes.
All right, interrupt. We're going to get, listen, this is an incredible story, and we will be talking more about this. All of these fake accounts coming after Nunes, implying that he colluded with prostitutes and cocaine addicts, and this was with the cooperation of Twitter, and that's why the $250 million lawsuit. We'll be hearing more about that, you can bet. Hans von Spakovsky joins us next to talk about the Covington High School case and the lawsuit against CNN and Washington Post. Stay tuned.
When an abortion-minded woman walks into a preborn pregnancy center, she encounters love and compassion. and gets to meet her baby by ultrasound.
And I was like, I'm going to go to the abortion clinic. And I already had my mind made up.
This mom didn't make it to the abortion clinic. Instead, God led her to a preborn center.
And the lady is giving me my ultrasound. She's like making these weird faces, and then she's like, it's two. And I'm like, I just start crying. I start texting my friends, and like, I can't.
The Ministry of Preborn was able to help this mom save not just one life, but two through ultrasounds. Preborn centers help save babies' lives and souls. Preborn runs and leads Christian pregnancy centers all over the country. To find out more, go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 and say baby. Your love can save a life.
This is Pause to Pray. A moment each day to pray for our country's leaders.
Today we pray for President Trump, who meets today with Brazilian leader Jair Bolsonaro. The president is working to strengthen the alliance between the two countries in light of the recent instability with Venezuela. Romans 8:28 reminds us of the importance of working together to fulfill God's plan. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Almighty God, we ask You to guide President Trump as he works to strengthen the alliance between the United States and Brazil. We also ask that there be peace and stability in South America. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of the Presidential Prayer Team, a nonprofit, nonpartisan ministry dedicated to encouraging prayer for our nation's leaders. To learn more, go to pausetopray.org.
Fox News Commentary with Todd Starnes.
A shocking poll about President Trump. That story next.
Truett McConnell University.
Hey, my name is Aaron Abbs. I am an undecided major, and I'm a freshman here at TMU. And as soon as I came here, I fell in love with the campus. Like, I knew, like, God was calling me to be here at TMU. And, you know, I couldn't get a better education than this. Like, professors who pray before class, who care about your spiritual walk with Christ. You are who you are, and they care about you.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
More than half of Americans now say President Trump is the victim of a political witch hunt. Those shocking findings in a new survey conducted by USA Today and Suffolk University. A growing number of Americans also are losing trust in special counsel Robert Mueller. Now, there seems to be genuine surprise within the mainstream media about that poll. I mean, why aren't Americans buying their narrative? Well, Americans understand what's really going on. The media bias, the fake news, the deep state. Just the other day, Reuters admitted they sat on damaging information about Robert Francis O'Rourke. During his younger years, the 46-year-old was a member of a nefarious computer hacking group. Reuters did not disclose that information until after the 2018 Senate race. Now, do you think for a minute Reuters would have done the same thing for Ted Cruz? I'm Todd Starnes.
That's your Fox News commentary.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Last January, 16-year-old Nicholas Sandman was falsely targeted, attacked, vilified, and threatened. The Washington Post, owned by the richest man in the world, led the print media's false attacks against Nicholas's reputation. CNN led the broadcast media's charge against Nicholas. Both recklessly spread lies about a minor to advance their own financial and political agendas. Despite raw video debunking the false narrative, The Post and CNN double down on their reckless lies.
He clearly doesn't blame himself. He puts the blame on the adults.
Lies that will forever haunt and endanger the life of an innocent young man.
I blame that f***ing kid. What a little f***.
Lies that further divided our nation. How long will we allow these media giants to tear at the fabric of our lives to further their own agendas? Will they ever be held accountable?
Lawyers representing Nicholas Sandman have just filed a bombshell defamation suit.
Yes, they will. Nicholas Sandman has taken a stand for himself and for you by filing major lawsuits against CNN and the Washington Post. Nicholas and his legal team will not be stopped until these Goliath corporations are held accountable for their lack of journalistic integrity. Until then, no one's reputation is safe.
If you took the time to look at the full context of what happened that day, Nicholas Sandman did absolutely nothing wrong. If they can get away with this against a 16-year-old boy, then we're all at risk. There has to be change.
Sandy Rios with you. That is so powerful and so well done. And it was, I suppose, put together at least at the behest of the attorneys defending Nicholas Sandman, who are not defending now, they're going on the offense against CNN and the Washington Post. I mean, it is stunning. It is a stunning story. And I think so seldom do we ever see any of these media or Hollywood or political elites who destroy people left and right with impunity. We never see them brought to account. We never see it. And that's why I think this whole lawsuit is so very refreshing. Well, does it have merit? Can they actually accomplish this? Can they really sue the Washington Post and CNN? They're such big entities. They have so much money. This is a kid, a 16-year-old boy in Kentucky, represented by some attorneys in Kentucky. And so, you know, can they really prevail? I want to know that, don't you? And so someone who's been writing about it and knows such a great amount about the laws, Hans von Spakovsky. Hans is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and he joins us this morning. Hans, thanks for joining us.
Sandy, it's great to talk to you again.
You know, I have to say that in looking at this lawsuit, and you recount some of this in your article, Hans, I was reminded of how really horrible the things that CNN and I guess the Washington Post as well said about Nicholas. Maybe you could I mean, I've got the text in front of me, but if you can recall some of the things that they actually said and did, what do you remember?
Well, the chief thing here, I think, for people to remember is that Nick Sandman didn't do anything. You know, he was standing by the Lincoln Memorial with the other Covington High School kids, and they were waiting for their bus to take them back to Kentucky when a black cult group, the Black Israelites, they call themselves, started yelling racial epithets at these kids. Instead, the Washington Post and CNN in particular, they got it completely reversed. They claimed that Sandman and the kids had been the ones harassing this other group. Then a Native American activist, a guy who later completely lied about what happened, marched up to these kids banging a drum and inserted himself into this crowd, going right up and standing right in Sandman's face. And again, CNN and others got it completely wrong. They claimed that Sandman and his fellow students, that they were taunting this Native American, that they were blocking his being able to get out of there. They got everything completely wrong and totally reversed. That's an important fact, because they got the facts of the story wrong and condemned, you know, Sandman as this horrible racist. And they particularly went after him. Why? Because he was wearing a souvenir Make America Great hat on.
And, you know, we need to repeat that these boys from this Catholic Boys High School in Covington were in Washington, D.C. to attend the March for Life. There's a
That's
lot of
right.
things in this story. And so these protesters, the black, I can't ever think of their name, Black Hebrew Israelites, and the
right.
Indian tribes were there, I think, well, of course, I'm speculating this, I have to say. It seemed as though they were there to disrupt that march. And so I want to read, because honestly, Hans, I just want people to hear the actual words, because I think they are even more egregious than even our telling of it. And you have them in your article. Let me just repeat. In the lawsuit accuses CNN of at least 4 defamatory TV broadcasts and 9 defamatory online articles falsely accusing Sandman and his fellow students of, quote, engaging in racist conduct by instigating a threatening confrontation with several African-American men, the Black Hebrew Israelites, and subsequently instigating a threatening confrontation with Native Americans who were in the midst of prayer. In the midst of prayer, even that, Hans.
Right. It's completely false.
Yeah, they're banging on drums and chanting, you know? And so then going on, you write, moreover, CNN asserted that Sandman and his fellow students displayed a racist mob mentality and, quote, looked like they were going to lynch, end quote, the black Hebrew Israelites who were merely, quote, preaching about the Bible nearby because, quote, they didn't like the color of their skin and their religious views. What was the truth of that interaction, Hans?
No, like I said, what amazed me was how calm these students remained in the face of, for example, the black Israelites. Like I said, hurling racial names at them, calling them crackers, saying they're future school killers. I mean, all kinds of just really nasty things. And yet these students, and again, this Native American who then lied in interview after interview about what happened, coming up and confronting these kids, inserting himself into the middle of them, banging his drum loudly, and yet these kids remained completely calm, didn't lash out or anything else. It was the complete and total opposite of the way CNN and the Washington Post described what happened. And the thing is, they could have known that almost immediately because it was within hours that a full video was posted of what happened, and yet both the newspaper and the network really didn't bother to do the kind of real investigating and reporting that they should have done.
And to this day, they, as far as we know, unless something's happened in the last couple of days, CNN has yet to retract or apologize for anything that they wrote.
No, that's correct.
All right, so we've reestablished, Hans, what a tragedy, what a horrific slander this has been. In our own mind, that's what I would use to this kid. But then filing a defamation lawsuit is a very different thing. So that's what this law firm, are they based in Kentucky, Hans?
Well, there are several lawyers involved. There's a law firm based in Kentucky because that's where Sandman and his parents live, and that's where he goes to school. But they've also associated in another lawyer from Atlanta named Lynn Wood. And the reason that's significant is that, as you said, they filed a defamation lawsuit against both the Washington Post and now CNN. Well, Lynn Wood is very famous in Atlanta for another reason. He's the lawyer that represented Richard Jewell in Richard Jewell's defamation lawsuits against CNN, NBC, and other media folks after the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. You may recall, remember there was a bombing in Olympic Park in downtown Atlanta. There was a security guard there named Richard Jewell who actually helped a lot of the victims. But then all of a sudden, the media started saying, ooh, he was the guy who did it. He was the suspect, all of which it turned out to be completely false. Lynn Wood is the lawyer that Jewell retained, who filed defamation lawsuits against those media giants. And it's reported that Jewell was able to get $500,000 from NBC. And apparently CNN also decided to settle that defamation lawsuit and make a payment to Richard Jewell, although we don't know how much it was because that amount was never disclosed.
You know, let me just add, Hans, for people that don't remember that, and a lot of people won't, or they're too young, that Richard Jewell's life was really ruined. I don't know what he's doing now, but remember his face was in the news every night. He was this villain. He had done this bombing. That's the inference or even the statement. I mean, they really targeted him, and to think that he was innocent, and that was before we actually knew the news would go that far. Don't you think? I don't remember. Well, yes, I guess I do. This is the first case kind of like the one we're talking about today that I can remember. So now,
it is the first one I can remember. And you know, Sandman has a big advantage in this defamation lawsuit, and that's because he's not a public figure. And the Supreme Court back in the 1960s, in a case called New York Times versus Sullivan, they created this distinction in defamation lawsuits between people who are private figures and people who are public figures. Public figures are you know, politicians, celebrities, people who are in the news all the time. And what the Supreme Court said was that if you're a public figure, you not only have to prove that the statements made against you were false, but also that whoever made them, like CNN, that they knew they were false when they made them, or they were so reckless that, you know, they might as well have known. If you're a private figure, you're not somebody who's a public official or a celebrity, and that's Nick Sandman. All you have to prove is that what CNN and Washington Post said about you was false.
You don't even have to prove that they intended to defame you or to print something that was false.
That is exactly right. You just have to show that it was false. And, you know, I'm sure that the Washington Post and CNN will try to argue that Sandman made himself a public figure by participating in the March for Life in Washington, but that's an argument that they will lose.
Yeah, that's silly. Does that mean all
well,
you know?
Well, I think what, it's silly too. But that's because in prior cases, the courts have said that even a private person can be can change himself into a public a limited public figure if he inserts himself into some public debate. But Sandman didn't do that. Just going to a rally, that doesn't count.
No, and they singled him out. He didn't exactly step forward. I mean, you can watch it. We can all see that with our own eyes. So, Hans, you actually think they have a chance of winning this suit? Is that what you're saying?
No, I do. Now, don't. No one should think it's going to be easy, because both the Washington Post and CNN have a lot of money that they can pour into defending this suit and making it as difficult as possible for Sandman and his family to win. But legally, if they can persevere, I think Sandman actually has a chance of winning it.
So if they were to, if a lower court, I don't know where this would be heard, I guess in Kentucky, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's where they've filed suit.
So what circuit then would that be appealed to? The fourth or fifth or?
Well, they have filed it, I think, in federal court in Kentucky. I don't think if CNN and the Washington Post lost, I don't think they would appeal the decision. I think they would come to some kind of settlement and pay it off, because I don't think they want a case like this going up to the higher courts. We should point out, by the way, that the lawsuit that they filed against the Washington Post, they're asking for $250 million in damages, which, not by coincidence, is exactly the amount of money that Jeff Bezos paid to buy the Washington Post.
That's just an amazing thing. And, of course, we are all cheering that they win. We really are cheering. What damage do you think, honestly, if the Washington Post and the New York Times were intent on rebuffing this, what kind of further damage could they do? What does Nicholas Sandman have to lose, or his family?
Well, you know, they're making the argument, and by they I mean their lawyers, that by basically telling people that he was a racist, that's in essence what they were doing. They were saying he was a racist, that he was part of a mob. Remember, at one point they were saying that it looked like they were going to lynch this person. That has so damaged his reputation that he's going to have to live with it for the rest of his life. Look, he's a high school student. How many liberal guidance counselors and admissions officers and colleges are going to take that into account when he's applying to school? And how much is it going to damage him in his professional career after that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the point is, of course, the damage has been done. And what further?
Right.
I don't think they could do further damage to them in a court proceeding. I think that's really what I was getting at. He's got really nothing to lose. And, of course, we're all cheering for Nick on this. Hans, if you could stay with me, it would be great. Because the one thing I have not really fleshed out, the Republicans, of course, 12 of them, voted against the president on his emergency declaration last week. The president vetoed it.
Right.
But now there's another effort. There's another effort to codify this. And I want to know what you, as a constitutional expert in the law, think about it. So we'll take a break. Hans, if you can stay with me, and we'll be right back. Hans von Spakovsky, our guest, will put his article on our Facebook page.
But evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. California Assemblyman Jesse Gabriel has proposed a bill that would force every public or private school in the state to place the phone number of a Planned Parenthood or similar place on student IDs. AB 624 would take effect in 2020 and require that schools place on every ID for grades 7 through 12 a sexual assault hotline, a domestic violence hotline, and a sexual or reproductive health hotline. Reproductive health is the phrase baby murder proponents use to cloak the barbarism. Why is California so committed to forcing citizens to become spokespersons for abortion?
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner. For more, from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
On the next Today's Issues, our guest will be Sandy Rios of Sandy Rios in the Morning.
Did you know that the terrorist, the shooter who killed those 50 Muslims in that mosque, was brought down by an armed parishioner in the second mosque?
We'll also have news headlines and analysis from American Family News. Don't miss the next Today's Issues, weekday mornings at 11 Eastern, 10 Central on American Family Radio and on Facebook.
It's no secret how American Family Radio is influencing lives.
Thank you for keeping us informed and for being a light in the darkness.
Have you called to share your story? Now is the time to do so as we approach our three-day share-a-thon.
Without AFR that day, there's no telling where I could have wound up.
These remarkable stories become powerful reminders of how God is using listener-supported American Family Radio. Call 877-876-8893.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. As ordinary Americans, we are victimized by horrible policies that we detest but elites love. Why do they impose these dangerous, liberty-destroying policies on us? One reason, they never have to live with the real-life consequences of their own ideas. They live in gated communities that are constantly patrolled and have walls around them. Here's what historian and author Victor Davis Hanson says about the refusal of the elites in Washington to fund a border wall to protect us from crime and drugs. They have the means, the influence, the capital to make walls and live in nice neighborhoods. They're never subject to the ramifications of their abstract ideology, and if they were, they wouldn't tolerate this for one second, and that's why people are mad about it. Methinks it's time to elect some new and different Republicans.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. There's something bizarre about the incessant media coverage given to the despicable attacks that killed 50 Muslims in New Zealand mosques last week, the roughly simultaneous murders of some 120 Christians who were hacked to death by jihadists in Nigeria has gone relatively unreported. The sharply contrasting attention to these incidents is the more remarkable since the reprehensible mistreatment of Muslim minorities around the world, even when the million or more Uyghurs being jailed in communist Chinese gulags are included, pales by comparison to the upwards of 245 million Christians being heavily persecuted globally. Whatever the reason for this disparate coverage, it feeds the grievously false impression that so-called Islamophobia is a massive and growing problem, whereas the actual intensifying persecution of Christians by Sharia supremacists and others is not. The media's silence only emboldens the perpetrators to redouble their oppression. This is Frank Affney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios, Sandy Rios, back with you. Interesting news. The president's approval ratings have maintained the bounce that they got after his last address to the country. In fact, it's 2 points above that. It's 47% as of March. No. It's 40. Just a minute. I got the wrong president. 44% as of yesterday. And interestingly, when Rasmussen tracked the comparable approval ratings of other presidents in the past, Barack Obama was at 47% in March of 2011. George W. Bush was at 58%. That was around the start of the Iraq War. Remember that, rolling, those tanks rolling? His percentage of support was 58%, and Bill Clinton was at 48% in March of 1995. So Bill Clinton at 48, Barack Obama at 47, President Trump at 44. Rasmussen says, though, that because this is an average of polls, Mr. Trump is on par with Obama and also with Bill Clinton. So I think that's interesting. I'm sure you do, too. Hans von Spakovsky is my guest. Hans is a legal fellow, senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Hans, before we move on, we were just talking about Nicholas Sandman and the lawsuit. We're going to put that, by the way, that video on our Facebook page so that you guys can see it and share it because it's so powerful. But I'm going to ask you about something I did not warn you about, Hans. So I'm telling everybody right now that I did not warn you about this, but I know you that you keep in touch, you keep your finger on the pulse of most everything, so at least I'm sure you have a short opinion. Probably you saw in the last 24 hours that Devin Nunes is filing a lawsuit of $250 million, seems to be the favorite number now, against Twitter basically defaming him and his family. It's an amazing story, too. In fact, I was going to read one of the accounts. They were made-up accounts. In fact, here it is. One of the defendants, identified as Liz Meyer, purportedly published tweets that implied that Nunes colluded with prostitutes and cocaine addicts, and that Nunes does cocaine, and that Nunes was involved in a Russian money laundering front. That's just a tiny little bit of the complaint, and I don't expect you to know about it, but I do want to know what you think about him being able to sue such a big entity as Twitter. Hans, what do you think?
Well, he's going to be moving into unknown territory. You know, Twitter is going to argue that it's not like a newspaper, that it's not responsible. You know, a newspaper, if they publish a letter to the editor and it turns out it's false and defamatory, the newspaper is going to be responsible for that. Twitter is going to argue that they're not that, they're just a platform, they're not responsible for what people post on there, although then they're going to, you know, the counter-argument is going to be, yeah, but you have all these policies in place in which you take down people's tweets that you don't think, you know, comply with a particular community standards. So, you know, this really hasn't happened before, and he's going to be forging new law with this kind of a lawsuit. I hope he's got deep pockets, because it's clear to me that Twitter will spend a lot of money defending this, because if he's successful, it will open up Twitter to many, many lawsuits, because this isn't the first time this has happened.
No, and it is fascinating, Hans. It's complex, and I'm just reading about it this morning myself, so I'm not prepared to discuss it either, except my understanding at this point is that the clear point is that Twitter allowed these fake accounts to spring up, like Devin Nunes'
right.
mom and others, in which the platform was used to defame him, of course, and he alleges because of his involvement in the pushback on the Russian collusion scandal. And so Twitter was the platform upon which people then went after him and faked accounts. And while Twitter looked the other way about those, Twitter then actually blocked Devin Nunes' own Twitter account. I think that's going to be the nut of it. Anyway, it's interesting. And once you've had a chance to study, we'll have to have another conversation about this. I also want to add, this is another, I'm surprising you, so forgive me. But also relating to Twitter, something else came out last night, and that was that Attorney General Barr has asserted what's called the state secrets privilege for the first time since he was sworn in last month. And this is about a lawsuit that was brought by Twitter complaining that its First Amendment rights are being violated by the government's refusal to allow the firm to publish more detailed statistics on national security letters and surveillance orders the firm receives under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Now, I know, I'm not expecting you to be an expert on this, Hans, because I'm springing this on you. But do you know anything in general about that state secrets privilege or anything in general about this particular issue?
Well, no. I mean, I know generally that, occasionally the government will go to companies, big companies like Microsoft and Twitter and others, when they are engaging in secret investigations over potential terrorism or foreign espionage, they will go to these companies when they're seeking information and documentation potentially on those espionage activities, and those folks are obligated to keep that secret under federal law. And it sounds like what Twitter is saying is they don't want to keep this secret, and that's only asserted, you know, in situations usually where revealing publicly that the government's engaged in, for example, perhaps investigating a Chinese agent who might be using Twitter, that obviously that could ruin the investigation.
Yeah, so William Barr stepping in to block that lawsuit. And so it's interesting, all kinds of lawsuit stories this morning. And, of course, Twitter being involved in two of them on opposite sides of the spectrum, the one where they are suing the government and the other where they're being sued by Devin Nunes. I want to turn to something else that is pretty egregious. As you and I both know, and everybody knows by now, 12 Republicans, I forgot what it's called, they voted on
it was a resolution to end the national emergency.
Okay, thank you. It was a resolution, and 12 Republicans, and I'll name them. It was Alexander from Tennessee, Roy Blunt from Missouri, Susan Collins from Maine, Mike Lee from Utah, Jerry Moran from Kansas, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, Rand Paul from Kentucky, Rob Portman from Ohio, Mitt Romney from Utah, and Marco Rubio from Florida. 12 of them voted for this resolution with the Democrats to stop the emergency declaration. Now, Hans, let's just talk to the first step here. They are claiming they had like some high noble cause in kind of trying to spare the constitutional divide between the president's ability to authorize money that the Congress hasn't authorized for certain spending. What do you think about that argument, and is it true?
I think they made a very basic mistake. I mean, I've heard some people trying to compare this to Barack Obama and his establishment of the deferred action for childhood arrivals program when he basically provided amnesty to illegal aliens. It's not the same thing at all. But the difference is that, look, in Obama's case, Obama was actually violating federal immigration law by giving amnesty and government benefits. Trump didn't violate a federal law when he declared a national emergency. In fact, he declared the national emergency in compliance with the National Emergency Act. And second, he didn't say he was going to use money that had already been appropriated by Congress in a way that Congress hadn't approved. No, he cited a specific federal statute that says that if the president declares a national emergency, he can use these funds out of the military construction fund to support the troops in whatever manner he believes is necessary. And he had already sent troops to the border and said that these funds would be used to support the troops in securing the border. So you may not agree with that action, but he was doing it actually pursuant to a federal law. So I think those Republicans, frankly, were misreading the situation.
Well, and of course, now they're doubling down. They're claiming this. They're going about the noble cause of changing that the act that the president was authorized to do this by. They want to change
right.
that. Mike Lee's writing it, and I also think Rand Paul's writing another version of it, too. Do you think that's a worthy pursuit, apart from the particulars of President Trump's emergency declaration?
Well, I do think the one thing that might be a good idea is this. Remember, the National Emergency Act was passed in the mid-1970s. There have been almost 60 national emergencies declared by presidents since Jimmy Carter, including about a dozen by Barack Obama, and many of those are still in force. So I actually think that, for example, putting in an expiration date of saying that, a national emergency will end after, say, 2 years or 3 years with the president having the option to redeclare it, that actually might be a good idea. But that wasn't really the issue here. If these Republicans think this is such a bad idea, well, why haven't they introduced a resolution to end all the other emergency declarations that are still in force, including the ones declared by Barack Obama?
Yeah, good question. And I think also, too, Hans, I find myself asking, you know, this kind of an endeavor, which that sounds like they are now doubling down on. I'm just reading, I believe, in Politico this morning. They're getting all ramped up to do this. And they're talking about how lots of Republican senators who voted with the president on this even now are going to turn their attentions to this endeavor to stop or to alter that that emergency declaration law. So the point is, you know, there's so much to do right now. There's so many serious things, and this can't be accomplished now with the House having its current configuration. Oh, what possible excuse? The Senate has a lot to accomplish. What possible reason would they take this on right now? Honestly.
Look, I don't understand it. And in particular, look, we do have a crisis at the border. The number of people trying to get in illegally has skyrocketed. We have organized caravans of thousands of immigrants, illegal aliens, hitting the border in a way we've never had before. I think they ought to spend a bit more time trying to figure out how to prevent that rather than worrying about the National Emergencies Act that was passed in the 1970s.
Yeah, I do too. I actually find it appalling. And we just got a couple of minutes left. This is not directly connected, but kind of. And this is something else you've been writing on. We've been discussing it at least periodically, and that is about the whole business of the citizenship question being asked in the 2020 census.
Right.
And of course, the left is up in arms. It's no, you shouldn't be asked. No one should be asked if they're an American citizen because it will reduce representation in places like California, New York, and fill in the blanks. So where are we with that, Hans?
Well, we've had two federal district courts, one in California, one in New York, both Obama appointees, who issued an injunction, you know, just what you expect, saying, that the Trump administration can't reinstate a citizenship question on the census. However, that was appealed, and the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take the case, and it's on an expedited schedule. There are going to be oral arguments before the Supreme Court on April 23rd. So we will get a decision by the end of June for sure, when the term ends in the Supreme Court, as to whether or not a citizenship question can be on the U.S. Census. And I suspect and hope that the Supreme Court is going to say it's okay, particularly because, you know, the opponents of this are painting this as if this is something new and unusual. You know, the first time that there was a citizenship question on the U.S. Census was in 1820. And it was on there because President Thomas Jefferson recommended that that question be asked.
Well, that's pretty controversial then, Hans, if Thomas Jefferson suggested, the writer of the Constitution.
Right.
Well, it's more ridiculousness that actually has such serious results if the right decision isn't made. Hans, thanks for all your great writing and following this. Hans von Spakovsky of Heritage Foundation, and we appreciate your expertise and always your time, Hans. Thank you for joining me.
Sure thing, anytime.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Enjoyed? Question mark. I know you find yourself concerned, so am I. So we just continue to pray, don't we? And do everything you can to stop it. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.